Welcome to Real Talk. It's Tuesday, November 7th. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and Real Talk is the show where we discuss anything that piques my interest and hopefully yours, dear listener. Our guest today is going to give us some insight into what's coming next. He's the author of The Next America, served as executive president of the Pew Research Center, and is a former politics reporter at The Washington Post, as well as the author of See How They Run and co-author of The Old News versus The New News. He is Encore Senior Fellow Paul Taylor, writer, speaker, and researcher who specializes in demographic change and generational trends. Welcome, Paul. Can you hear us?
I can hear you. Delighted to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us. The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. That sounds pretty dramatic. Are we looking at Soylent Green?
Well, we are at a really, dramatic moment in our history. We are in a moment where we have two demographic changes that are playing out at the same time. Our population is en route to becoming majority non-white, and it is also a record share of us, like me, I'm 68 years old, a record share of us are going gray. Mm-hmm. Either of these would be the dominant demographic story of its era. The fact that they're happening simultaneously has created generation gaps. We are at a moment in history where young and old don't look alike, don't think alike, don't form families alike, don't vote alike, don't use technology alike, et cetera, et cetera. And this is putting stress on a lot of realms of society, particularly our sense of social cohesion and particularly our politics. We are in a moment in history where our politics has gotten particularly ugly. It's gotten almost tribal. It's my tribe against your tribe.
Yeah.
And one tribe, broadly speaking, is younger and browner. And more cosmopolitan, more liberal, more immigrant-friendly, and the other is older and whiter and more conservative and more religious and nationalistic, et cetera, et cetera. I wrote this book a few years ago. It wasn't that much about politics, but just in the few years since it first came out, these demographically driven political differences have leapt to the fore. Here we are at the one-year anniversary of the election of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. In what, in my lifetime anyway, was, I think it's fair to say, the most divisive, the most raw presidential election, because so much of it was, again, my truth against your truth, my team against your team, rather than arguing about issues. So here we are. It's a tough moment.
So
although,
how does that
I'm
make...
an American and I'm an optimist, and I think that we will... There are many realms outside of politics where we're doing much better with these changes, but at the moment... it's kind of all politics all the time, and it's not a pretty picture.
So when you roll all that together, your detailed data explores where we are headed, and if you combine that with what you've seen in the 2.5 to 3 years since you wrote this book, what do you think our next America is going to look like?
Well, there are certain things I can say with confidence, because as you said, a lot of the book is built on data. And some of it is classic demographic census data, and the Census Bureau can project forward. Now, these projections aren't locked in stone, and they may be off by a few percentage points here and there, but to a large degree, demographics is the future we already know. These population trends are baked in to birth rates, death rates, immigration rates that tend not to change dramatically. So, one of the things I can say, and the book projects out to the middle of the century, 2050, sometime between 2040 and 2050, according to the Census Bureau, we will be a majority non-white country. That's a shocking, I've been giving talks about this all over the country. That is a shocking statistic in many parts of the country. It's not a shocking statistic on the West Coast, particularly California, but also other West Coast states, because you're ahead of the rest of us in terms of living this change. This change
yes.
is driven by our modern immigration wave, which is now 50 years old. It's in numbers, it's our largest in our history. 60 million immigrants have come in the last 50 years. And in addition to doing what all previous immigration waves have done, replenishing our economy, bringing entrepreneurship, bringing laborers, this one has given us this racial makeover. Our earlier immigration waves were almost entirely right European. This immigration wave is mostly Hispanic and increasingly now Asian. Asians have surpassed the Latinos as the largest immigrant group. So that one is a no-brainer. That's where we're going. The other no-brainer is we're getting older. Today, about 15% of our population is 65 and over. By the middle of the century, that number will be 22-23%. And the two of these things, I say, happening simultaneously, create lots of challenges. They create challenges that are economic. How do we fund Social Security and Medicare when the whole arithmetic of those programs is based on the ratio of workers to retirees? And we now, one reason we're getting older is my generation, the baby boom generation, is at the rate of 10,000 a day migrating from the labor force to retirement. And this happens every single day between now and 2030. And
well,
by the time, and at that point, the math of the two most important and most successful programs we've enacted as a society, Social Security and Medicare, it just simply doesn't work. They haven't collapsed yet. They haven't run out of money yet. But we can pinpoint the bean counters. Can pinpoint the moment it'll happen.
Well, in addition
to that,
there's
all the incentive in the world to take this on sooner rather than later. But it's politically difficult, and we're in this moment of political dysfunction. So we kind of kick the can down the road.
Yeah, we continue to do that. But in addition to that, those in the baby boomer generation are not retiring in the numbers that we anticipated that they would because they don't have the money. And the millennials are standing in the wings waiting to take their jobs.
Yeah.
How do you see that happening? What sort of clash do you see coming among those generations?
Well, it's a really good question. And where I would start to answer it is by saying that at the most important venue or the most important point where older and younger adults interact with each other is the family. And again, I think boomers came of age 40 or 50 years ago with kind of a chip on their shoulder towards their parents' generation, if not towards their parents specifically. Never trust anybody over 30,
I
hope I die before I get old. And the feeling, was that our parents' generation had screwed everything up, and thank God we were here to make it right. This generation of young adults, some of whom are, in fact, the children of the boomers, and so, but this generation of 20 and 30-somethings actually like their parents.
Mm-hmm.
A record share of them are still living in their parents' home. 32% of millennials are still living in their parents' home, in part because they're having such a hard time getting started. And you mentioned one reason, which is boomers are staying in the workforce longer. That is correct. But I think the bigger reason has to do with automation and globalization and some of these macroeconomic trends that are playing out all over the world. So at a personal level, they actually like and admire their parents. And their parents are being generous in terms of transfers of money, transfers of shelter in terms of housing them. And in many cases, caring for their own grandkids and the children of the millennials as part-time caregivers or full-time caregivers or whatever. So there's a lot to like about the intergenerational goodwill that exists within families. But then if you project out to the more societal level, you mentioned that a lot of boomers aren't financially ready for retirement,
right.
And there's no question that there's a challenge there. But the age cohort, the generation that is most challenged in today's economy, are the young and their children. We are in a moment in our history where this rising generation of young adults is the first downwardly mobile generation in our history.
Well, where do the Gen Xers?
Very hard time getting started, hard time finding jobs. They're not getting married, and the marriage rates are down significantly. A lot of that has to do with the feeling I don't have the economic foundation yet to get married. It used to be older adults were our poorest cohort. Now younger adults and their children are our poorest cohort. And we really haven't adjusted our public policies to take up that challenge.
What about the Gen Xers? You don't mention them, at least. Where do they fit in your projections?
Well, they are in the middle, chronologically. They tend to get overlooked, and I'm as guilty as anybody by that. They're now in their late 30s to early 50s. One reason they have been overlooked is their numerically a smaller age cohort. They are the product of a birth dearth that followed the baby boom of the boomers' generation. And they also just culturally, whereas the baby boomers back in the 60s made a lot of noise with their counterculture, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, et cetera, and the millennials, as they have come of age in the last decade or so, have made a lot of noise. The sheer weight of their numbers, they're our largest generation ever, but also in terms of being our pioneers into the digital era, they've been very influential. So the Xers, if you look at a lot of their characteristics, they share a lot of traits of both generations, older and younger than them. In a lot of ways, we measure things, they are a transitional generation. I guess the last thing I would say is they have never been culturally as noisy a generation, so the fact that they get overlooked doesn't bother them that much. They came of age, the Gen Xers did, as the divorce rate was spiking,
yeah.
And children were not really at the center of the culture. You know, today we talk about today we talk about helicopter parents, mm-hmm. and, you know, the nurturing norms that have raised today's children and young adults, and you're special, everybody gets a trophy, et cetera, et cetera. You may remember a phrase from 20 or 30 years ago as the Xers were coming of age was latchkey children. You know, the family is falling apart. The house will be empty when you come home from school. Make yourself a healthy snack, do your homework, et cetera. So that's been their lot in life. I think it's led to a self-reliant, I'll put one foot in front of another and figure it out for yourself, a set of attitudes, although I should add that these are all gross generalizations.
Of course they are. That's unfortunately what you have to do with statistics. This is Real Talk, and we're talking with author Paul Taylor, author of The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. And we are able to continue with this show thanks to Windermere Vachon Real Estate. They support all our community information programming and our emergency alert service. I'm Susan McCabe, your host of Real Talk. Paul Taylor, we've been talking about the millennials and the Gen Xers and the baby boomers. I'm wondering how the values, if you could drill down into that, the values of each of these generations is going to impact what you might see as the future of America. And I say that because a lot of the millennials that I know here on this very liberal island on the West Coast are value the environment, value family, value human support. Some of them are going back to local farms. How do you see the values of the boomers, the Gen Xers, and the millennials shaping what tomorrow might look like?
Well, a couple of things I would say about the millennials, and I would start with them because they are, at 80 million strong, not only our largest generation numerically, but if you project forward, they're in their 20s into their mid-30s. This is the generation that increasingly will be the largest in the electorate, the largest in the workforce. They will start to take over leadership of all the core institutions of society. So in some ways, their values will determine the kind of country we are. And a couple of things stand out in terms of their values. Number one, whether you measure it purely politically in a partisan sense or in some of the underlying values behind what we associate with partisan and ideological labels, this is our most liberal generation that we've ever been able to measure in the 50, 60, 70 years that we've used public opinion survey research to measure core values. You see that in their voting patterns. There is a very large gap between how young and old vote. You go back to the 80s, 90s, and early aughts, young and old voted almost exactly alike in presidential elections. Starting about a decade ago, as millennials started to come into the electorate, you saw a big gap, and there's 10, 15, 20 percentage point gap between young who are more liberal, more big D Democratic in their votes. Behind that partisan behavior are a set of values, particularly on social issues, that really stand out. For example, if you think of two issues that have been very important since the turn of the millennium. Same-sex marriage. Now, you go back 10, 15 years, same-sex marriage was, you know, two-thirds of the country was against same-sex marriage. Today, two-thirds of the country is in favor of same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. It's hard to think of a more fundamental sort of social, cultural, political issue where there's been that much change in that short a time frame. In the course of these last 10 or dozen years, every age group has become more supportive, but very much led by the young, who started out more supportive and become ever more so. So you get, for example, 75-80% of millennials support same-sex marriage, whereas boomers, that might be 35 or 40%. Used to be 20% for boomers. So everybody's gotten more supportive, but it's the millennials leading the way. You see almost exactly the same pattern on immigration, which obviously has been a very, very divisive political issue.
Mm-hmm.
But here is the same pattern. You go back to the mid-90s. There's a question that the Pew Research Center and other polling groups asked. It's very straightforward. Would you say all things considered, do immigrants strengthen our country by bringing new energy and talent and labor, or are they a burden to our country because they threaten our values and they take our jobs? In 1994, the public, by 60% to 30%, said they are a burden to our country. Today, the public, by 65 to 28%, say they strengthen our country. This despite the divisive rhetoric, despite, frankly, the election of Donald Trump, who ran on an anti-immigrant campaign and got elected president. And again, if you go inside the data on where that change has come, it's very similar to same-sex marriage and a whole basket of issues like this. Everyone has gotten more supportive, despite the divisive rhetoric, very much led by the young. And the young, let me close by saying, that helps explain some of this, the young are the product of this immigration wave. Boomers, about 75% of boomers are white. Millennials, only 55% of millennials are white. And the 45% who are non-white increasingly are the children, are immigrants themselves or the children of immigrants. So they're much more of a rainbow. It's sort of hardwired into how they've grown up, who they are. It doesn't mean everybody's kumbaya. It doesn't mean there aren't racial tensions even among the young. That's simply a fact of human nature. But I would say that as in terms of navigating the challenges that come from an increasingly diverse society, the fact that it's the millennials who will be kind of running our culture and our politics for the coming decades, we're in pretty good hands because they have a set of values that it seems to me will manage that well.
It sounds like it's fair to say that, their values might provide them the equipment to solve the problems that we're going to face, the very human problems with the generational showdown, as you put it.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Well, and you mentioned the environment. I'm not familiar with all the details of your listener, but a very similar set of issues on the environment, where it's the younger adults who are much more attuned to the challenges we face from global warming, and much more eager to be proactive in terms of taking this on.
So with Gen Xers taking leadership roles in politics and millennials coming up, how do you see these groups able to deal with the extreme of politics that we're now experiencing?
Well, based on where we are, on November 7th of 2017, I would have to say not very well. I painted a moment ago a somewhat rosy scenario, saying based on the values of the rising generation, I think we're going to be okay in the long run. We are on a very bumpy walk to the long run, and I don't know how long and how disruptive those bumps will be, because there is a portion of the population, and they tend to be more weighted towards the older groups and some of them within the middle-aged groups as well, who are threatened by the cultural and demographic and racial changes that are underway, who feel like they're strangers in their own country, who feel like, this always happens at times of change. There is always a backlash to change,
mm-hmm.
and particularly there's a backlash to immigrant-driven change. We basically closed our doors to immigration back in the 1920s after almost 80 solid years of European immigration because the country had had enough, and those doors stayed closed through the Great Depression, through World War II. But by about 50 years ago, in the mid-60s, we opened back up, and we've had this huge immigration wave, and we're having some backlash to it. Here's and this immigration wave, in addition to replenishing our economy, is turning us into a coat of many colors. So it's changing our racial complexion. There are two statistics I sometimes use to portray how much change there has been. If you go back to when Barack Obama's parents were married and Barack Obama was born, that was 1961, about 56 years ago. And we can stipulate, not to start a political argument, these events, in fact, happened in Hawaii, not in Kenya.
Right.
Something on the order of magnitude that year of one wedding in 1,000 in the United States was like that one between a black person and a white person. That mm-hmm. wedding was still illegal in a third of our states, gasp-inducing taboo everywhere else. And across all lines of race and ethnicity, only about 2.5% of weddings in 1961 were across lines of race and ethnicity. Today, 17% of all new weddings are people who marry out, whites who marry blacks or Hispanics or Asians, etc. 17% is a lot, starting from a base of nearly zero. At the same time, the new taboo is actually weddings across lines of partisanship. Just 9% of recent weddings are between Republicans and Democrats. So we've kind of traded one taboo for another. We've traded one tribal barrier for another.
That's great.
I would like to think at the end of the day, our original sin as a country starts with race and starts with slavery, and we've been at it for several hundred years trying to make progress. It comes in fits and starts. I think it's, on the racial front, there was a sense of kumbaya after Obama was elected. Again, I was doing surveys for Pew Research at the time. I think the whole country was astonished. Mm-hmm. Whites and African Americans in particular, many of them said, I never thought I'd see this day come. And there was a feeling, boy, if we can get over this milestone, maybe we really are in a post-racial America. Well, if you look at attitudes about race today, 8 years after, nearly 9 years after Obama was elected, they've actually gotten worse during his tenure.
Yes, they have.
We know the history around mm-hmm. Some of the police shootings and Black Lives Matter and backlash to all that. So we haven't achieved kumbaya, but the fact that the racial lines literally are becoming more permeable, and our fastest-growing racial group in this country is mixed race, I think holds us in good stead, certainly along with the attitudes of younger adults towards race. Now, can we get to a place where Democrats and Republicans don't treat each other as aliens from a distant planet who are out to wreck the country?
That could be harder.
I would like to think we'll get there, but it's hard to see the way forward at the moment.
So, another question. How does the U.S. compare to other rapidly aging nations? We've got our plurality and our history of slavery and a whole lot of other problems working against kumbaya. Does it work better in other rapidly aging nations that may be a little more homogeneous?
I think we do diversity, warts and all. As well, we are the most diverse country in human history. We've been at this a long time. Our founding motto was "E pluribus unum," out of many, one. Mm-hmm. That motto was created by a committee made up of Jefferson and Franklin and Adams, appointed on July 4, 1776. They were astonished then at the diversity of the fact it wasn't just British who were there. It was British, and it was Irish, and it was Scottish, and it was Dutch, and it was some French. And they said to themselves, my God, how in the world can we possibly handle this much diversity?
Little did
they know.
We've
been at this a long time. It's often ugly, but I can't think of a culture that actually has gained more from diversity than we have, and I think that is going to continue. On the aging side, this diversity, this immigrant driven diversity is actually keeping us younger than we would have otherwise been. Our median age today is 37. By the middle of the century, it'll be 41, so we're getting older. But if you look at all the world's leading economies, Japan will be 50, median age will be 53 by the middle of the century, Germany 52, China 47, will be 41. We're 37 now. Our immigration-driven diversity is keeping us younger. I actually think our demographics can be a wind at our back if we manage the challenge that always comes with diversity. It won't be easy. It isn't easy at the moment, but I'd put my money on us to do it pretty well.
And do you think our democracy is going to survive so that we can go through that messy process?
That's a good question. I mean, I can't remember a time when our core democratic processes have been more dysfunctional for a longer period of time than right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're at the 50th anniversary of some of the most disruptive times in my life, the late 60s, anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, assassinations, riots in the cities, et cetera. And yet even then, and I have survey data to point that out, even in the late 60s, if you asked Americans of all ages and all ideologies and races, et cetera, all things considered, you basically trust the government to do what's right. 75% of Americans said yes to that question in the 60s. Today, 20% of Americans say yes to that question. So there's a lot of feeling that government is dysfunctional. I think part of the dysfunction is that we send people to Washington who reflect this political polarization that's tribal and very raw. They don't go there with the instinct to compromise. They go there to defend the grievances of their half of the population. So you get dysfunction and you get gridlock and you get more frustration, and round the cycle goes. And that's where we've been for, pick your year, I would say 10, 15 years or more. I think, at the end of the day, and I have survey data that shows this isn't just my opinion, Americans are pragmatists. Most Americans want to get along. The loud voices we see on cable TV, we see on the social media, yes, they are a growing part of who we are. They are not a majority of who we are. Most people are pragmatists. They're not ideologues. They're good Americans. They get along in their families. They get along with their neighbors, and would like to be rid of this. But, boy, I'll be damned if I can figure out how we get from here to there.
Gosh, I thought you were going to have an answer. The only answer I can think of is...
If I do, I'll write another book.
Yeah, please. The only answer I can think of is get out and vote, exercise the only voice you
have. That's absolutely right. I mean, back to millennials, one of the reasons why their values haven't yet been fully reflected in our politics is they don't vote that much. Now, part of that is a life cycle thing. Young adults tend to vote at lower levels than middle-aged and older adults. That kind of comes with the territory. But frankly, part of it is the era they've grown up in, where every message they've gotten from government is, don't bother with government. Nothing ever happens. All they do is claw their eyes out.
Yeah.
And they look to technology or other realms, as vital places for change. And I would like to think if those behaviors change as they get a little bit older, we'll see their values better reflected in our politics.
Thank you, Paul Taylor. We have 1 minute left. And I just want to ask you quickly something about your history. In 1990, you founded the Alliance for Better Campaigns with Walter Cronkite and Gerry Ford and Jimmy Carter. Is there something about any of those individuals that stands out in your mind that might inform today? And can you answer that in 30 seconds?
Yeah. Well, you know what stands out? They were elder statesmen. They were respected across lines of partisanship and ideology. They reflected a love of the civic space, a desire to find common ground. These are lovely words. We've been saying these words as a country for 240 years. I would be hard-pressed in 2017 to find three prominent men, one from the media, two former presidents, who reflect, who could be embraced by the full population, in part because of the political polarization we're living through. I hope we'll come out of it.
I do, too. Paul Taylor, thank you so much for spending time with us here on Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host. We've been talking with Paul Taylor, author of The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown, which we hope is going to be peaceful. Thanks again for joining us, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned, folks. You never know what you're going to hear next on The Voice of Vashon. you're going to hear Vintage J&B at 1 o'clock with Bill Wood and Jeannie Doherty. Stay tuned. This is 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington.